Canada, which legalized assisted suicide in 2016. And in 2027, they are extending the benefits of assisted suicide and euthanasia to all people who are mentally ill. There's this immediate pressure that comes upon them to widen the criteria. There are 54 MPs already who have declared that the bill isn't wide enough. And if we think that they are going to go home as soon as it's passed, we're mistaken.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Kevin Yule. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be here.
Kevin, it's great to have you on. I have known you for a long time in your capacity as a writer, a historian, a contributor to Spiked for many, many years. But I think most listeners to the podcast will be familiar with you through the stuff you've been doing for Spiked on the issue of assisted dying, so-called assisted dying, assisted suicide, something you've been writing about with great passion, actually, and you've put forward an incredibly strong humanist case against assisted dying. And you've been doing that for quite some time, and Spike's been delighted to host so much of your commentary on that. So I thought for listeners, I would kick off with a broad question, which is just to ask you how you got interested in this issue. What is it that piqued your interest and your concern about this particular issue?
Well, it goes way, way back to when I was very young. I was 18, and a friend of mine, I lived in Canada at the time, and a friend of mine went off and shot himself in the head in a hotel room elsewhere. And it was just one of those shocking moments that when you're 18 makes you consider all sorts of things. And it's still something that last time I went back and I saw my friends, and we're all in our late 50s and 60s now. And everybody remembered that moment. Everybody remembered what happened to this young man. So that got us thinking, you know, I worked with his father and I just saw the horrible effects on his family. And I thought, this is a bad action. Suicide is generally a bad thing. We did go through the issues, you know, oh, should it actually be something that we support? Is it his own decision? How should we understand his action? And we all decided that it was a bad thing and that we can forgive him for it. But it is, you know, it had a huge effect on his family and friends to this day. So that's what started me off. And then when Dr. Kevorkian, some of people might be old enough to remember who Dr. Kevorkian was, he was the doctor in the United States who created what he called a mercytron, which did basically assist suicides. And the person had to press on to release some drugs into their veins. And he had concocted this. And when that came up, I remember thinking, no, this is wrong. We should not be encouraging any form of suicide. So that's what set me off, really. And I published my first article on it way back in 1996. When you were just out of short trousers, I imagine, Brendan.
Yeah, just about. That's a very useful opening. And the thing that strikes me immediately listening to you there is your use of the word suicide. Because we can dig down into this in a bit more depth, but it's notable by its absence in a lot of this discussion. So one of the reasons I was very keen to speak to you this week is that, of course, the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill is going through the House of Commons, and MPs have a free vote on it on Friday this week, the week that we're speaking. And the name of the bill doesn't have the word suicide in it. A lot of people are referring to it as an assisted dying bill, so you're helping someone to die. And it's such a striking element of this whole issue that you rarely hear the word suicide. So I think some people will even be surprised to hear you tie this issue of assisted dying, as it's referred to your friend committing suicide all those years ago. So explain to us a bit about why you think it's important to understand this within the realm of suicide. How does your thinking work in relation to that?
Well, I think, you know, there is the question, is it suicide? And I would argue, basically, that if I put a gun to my head and shoot myself, that I think everybody would recognize as suicide. if a doctor handed a rope to a woman knowing she was going to hang herself, I think we'd all recognize that as assisted suicide. But if a doctor hands deadly drugs that will end the life of somebody and this person takes them on purpose, I think it's ridiculous to call that anything other than suicide. I think it, you know, when you cause your own death, that is suicide. If it is your choice, I can't see that we should call it any other word. The assisted dying really only came up in about 2005, 2006. And it was basically a marketing term that allowed people who were pushing for assisted suicide to call it a nicer name. Anybody who has been on the underground in Westminster, for instance, may have seen all of the nice airbrushed posters with, you know, a young woman dancing around in her pajamas, celebrating dignity and dying, you know, and their crusade and talking about the terminally ill, assisted dying for a terminally ill bill. And I think that really indicates how the whole conversation has moved, in that there is branding experts who are coming in and airbrushing all of the messy and uncertain aspects out of death. And that's part of their message, is to try and, you know, say if somebody in a white coat comes along and does it with you, then that sanctions suicide. It's something that in my book in 2013, I talked about as being almost a sort of pseudo-religious idea that, you know, suddenly the priest moves away from the bedside and a doctor moves in and says, yes, you are suffering, my son. You may take your life. And I think assisted dying is just another marketing term, just like blanket ban and all of these other things. And there's this idea within, particularly within Dignity and Dying, which is the leading organization behind Kim Leadbeater's bill, there's an idea that you know, we can spend a lot of money and make glossy propaganda, and somehow that's going to convince people. And I think what we can see is that it will not. That whole advertising campaign with these images on the underground, which promote suicide, which people are finding ironic, given that the Tube is a notorious site for suicides. And also given that the Transport for London has banned adverts for junk food. So it's, I think I would insist that it's really, if we're going to be honest and we're going to start out with an honest conversation about that, we really have to admit that this is assisted suicide.
And it's interesting you mention Dignity and Dying, one of the lead campaign groups on this issue, which was originally called the Voluntary Euthanasia Society. So I just find the changing language so, so interesting. And I want to come back to that question of euthanasia and what, and the imperative behind some of this stuff and how it might be related to old ideas of euthanasia. I want to come back to that in a moment. But you mentioned there Kim Leadbeater, the Labour MP. She's bringing forward this bill, terminally ill adults, end of life. And as I say, MPs are going to vote on it. So let's talk a little bit about that bill specifically. I mean, I'm quite surprised. There has been a fairly healthy discussion as a consequence of this bill. And even some members of parliament have made some very good statements about the bill and why they're opposing it and their concerns and so on. But let's talk about the bill in a bit more depth. To kick us off, maybe you could just outline what the bill provides, or what it provides for, what it claims it will do if it were to pass through the Commons.
Well, it claims that it will allow terminally ill adults, of which there's an estimated maybe 5,000 a year is the figure that I've heard, who will be able to take their own lives. And they will be able to do so with a doctor, by talking to a doctor, and that doctor must get another doctor to agree. And then those doctors, the coordinating doctor, as he's called in the proposed legislation, must apply to a high court judge. And once that's okayed, then the coordinating doctor can, you know, give this medication. So that's the very simple idea of it. However, it rapidly gets complicated. There are as many questions, you know, as there are answers in this bill. So, for instance, if you're happy for me to go into the specifics of the bill, it doesn't prevent doctors from proposing assisted suicide, which is different from most legislation elsewhere, except in Canada, where this has become an issue to the extent where 25 doctors in Nova Scotia have resigned because they don't want to participate in this, and they don't want to have to say this. And that's the other aspect. It doesn't allow doctors to opt out of either discussing assisted suicide or to do what's called an effective referral, which means pointing the person in the direction of somebody who will give them a push off the proverbial edge, so to speak. So it doesn't prevent doctors from proposing it. So therefore, any good doctor is going to present all of the treatment options, I would have thought. And this is a huge problem. It's also the phrasing that it uses to define what is terminal illness. That could include people with type 1 diabetes, since insulin does not reverse the primary condition, and you can bring yourself to it within death if you have type 1 diabetes. It also could, rather shockingly, include those with anorexia and arthritis in the way that it's worded at the moment. The doctor can assist the person to take the drugs, but not cause death. And these are contradictory statements, open to abuse. There is no requirement to monitor the doctor's assessments, which is also a little bit odd. They can refer it to a high court judge, can ask for the information, but doesn't necessarily need to. There's also the use of a proxy to sign the form if the patient cannot sign it. Is also, I feel, open to abuse. It legalizes assisted suicides for patients whose deaths can be reasonably expected within 6 months. But as any doctor will tell you, it's impossible. It's like predicting the weather. You can predict it for the next week or so, but you cannot predict it for 6 months' time, and nor can doctors predict that a patient is going to die within 6 months. They can tell if somebody's going to die within a week, but they can't tell within 6 months. In fact, studies have shown that they get it as wrong more than they actually get it right. And about a third of patients live beyond a six-month prognosis. So that's also curious about the bill. The Secretary of State must ensure that assisted suicide is available, but she or he is under no such duty to provide palliative care to everyone who needs it. And this is one of the issues that has been very prominent in the discussion about this bill, is that palliative care should be open to everybody who wants it before this is offered. Many people are saying that. So it is a bit of a dog's dinner, this bill, really. There's also one of the bizarre clauses, I think it's 23, says that there is no coroner's reports on any of the deaths caused by assisted suicide, which is very, very odd, because that's a protection for people to ensure that no malfeasance occurs, and that's being removed. So there are all sorts of questions about the bill.
This episode of The Brendan O'Neill Show is brought to you by Beckett's Gin. With Christmas just round the corner, Beckett's Gin and Whiskey will make the ideal presents for your loved ones. And if they're anything like me, they'll find it impossible to go back to other brands. You can really taste the quality in all of Beckett's spirits. Unlike other gins that overwhelm you with a million different trendy flavors, Beckett's only use 6 botanicals. And they only use the best possible ingredients, like juniper berries handpicked in Surrey and mint leaves from Kingston-upon-Thames. Beckett's has something for everyone. Their London Dry Gin is a great all-rounder and is perfect if you're looking to elevate your classic G&T. I've been enjoying it with just a plain tonic to really let the flavour shine. And if you're looking for something a bit different, I can highly recommend Beckett's Slow Gin. They take their London Dry Gin and steep it in the finest slow berries, producing an incredible, rich, almost cherry flavour. With ginger ale and a slice of orange, it is the perfect Christmas drink.
Even if you're not into gin, Beckett's has you covered with their brand new whiskey. It's a nice and smooth English single malt, which has been matured in Beckett's slow gin casks, making it the first in the world to be produced this way. And since Beckett's is only producing around 300 bottles of their incredible whiskey each year, you will want to get in early. I'm also delighted to tell you that fans of this show can get a 20% discount on all Beckett's spirits, including their gin, their brand new whiskey, and more. Just head over to beckettsgin.co.uk/Brendan to claim your discount right now. That's BECKETTSGIN.co.UK/Brendan to get 20% off. beckettsgin.co.uk/Brendan.
That's a really useful outline, and there are a whole load of questions. I'm also very struck by the stipulation that the person going forward for a so-called assisted dying would have to be someone who was reasonably expected to die within 6 months. But I mean, a lot of people listening to this will know of people who were given such a timeline, and people can live longer than expected. And it's an extraordinary bill in the way you've just outlined it there. But one thing that a lot of people are saying, and Kim Leadbeater is leading the charge on this, they're talking about the safeguards in the bill. I've found this a slightly frustrating element of the discussion, because there's been a lot of focus on the safeguards, and I keep wanting to say, no, let's talk about the bigger principles, the larger moral, philosophical questions. But on the question of safeguards, it seems unconvincing to me, firstly, for the reasons you've outlined there, which is that there are not particularly good guardrails, and there's always the potential for a slippery slope. But also, if you look at the experiences of other countries, it seems pretty clear that even legislation that starts off in a ostensibly narrow focus on who might have the so-called right to die can very easily expand into other categories of people as well. So what have you made of the safeguards discussion? Are you convinced by the so-called safeguards? And what do you think the focus on that in particular tells us?
Well, I think what Kim Leadbeater is trying to do is to bring together the safest bill ever. That's what she actually explains it as, is that there are such safeguards that, for instance, you know, a judge must be involved in this decision, which is unlike any other country, as far as I know, and what they've included. It's not terribly practical, given that it has to be a high court judge. I think they can substitute somebody else, but there are 18 high court judges, which if we use the number that they use, which is 5,000 cases, that's going to inundate the courts as well as the National Health Service. So that's a very, very odd thing. I mean, the problem with safeguards is that it's impossible really to draw a line between those who you think should die and categorize them and say, you know what, we're going to prevent the suicide of all these groups over here, but this little group over here, we're going to actually encourage the suicides of. And once you hit that inherent problem, it's impossible to have safeguards that have any meaning whatsoever. There's no moral distinction between somebody with 6 months to die and 7 months to die. That's ridiculous. And even the mechanisms that she puts in are, you know, open to all sorts of problems. And the good news is that, like, when I first started writing about this issue a long time ago, as you know, we didn't have evidence to show that what I was predicting would happen would actually happen. Now, from other countries, we have evidence. The most egregious example, of course, is Canada, which legalized assisted suicide and euthanasia in 2016, where it had the stipulation that somebody had to be at their death as reasonably foreseeable was the phrase. And they removed that in 2020, and it basically gave the right to all disabled people to have an assisted suicide and or a euthanasia, probably just one or the other, actually. But yes, they increased that in 2020 to include anybody with a chronic condition, anybody who had a permanent chronic condition. And in 2027, they are extending the benefits of assisted suicide and euthanasia to all people who are mentally ill and suffering. So, I mean, one of the problems with the safeguards is that there's this immediate pressure that comes upon them to widen the criteria, and rightly so. There are 54 MPs already who have declared that the bill isn't wide enough. And if we think that they are going to go home as soon as it's passed, we're mistaken. And I think it will increase. In every country where it's been legalized, including Oregon, it is expanded to include more and more people. In Oregon, it expanded in 2020 and in 2023. This is the Oregon is the kind of model for Tim Leadbeater's bill. So it's very, very important. There's misinformation, shall we call it? We used to call it lies, didn't we? But it's misinformation being put about by Dignity and Dying that Oregon has never extended its laws, and it has. It extended it reduced the waiting time from 15 days to 48 hours, and in some cases less. People from outside of the state to be euthanized or to have an assisted suicide more accurately. Oregon restricts their program to only assisted suicide, but it allows now people from out of town to come in. And the other thing that, even though these cases are really badly documented, and this is one of the reasons we're so disturbed about the idea that the coroner can't actually assess what happened with the death, because I've seen a recent article that documents 60 cases of women, 100% women, who have had assisted deaths because they are anorexic. And these are mostly young women, mostly under the age of 30. And it's this shocking, and this has taken place in Oregon as well as other places, because, of course, you can bring yourself to a terminal condition by refusing to eat. So safeguards, I think I would point to the examples from abroad, but I'd also say that whatever these safeguards are actually in the Leadbeater bill, the real pressure on people will come because they feel a burden. This is a very important reason why people will go for this, is because I don't know whether everybody else's elderly relatives have said this, but many elderly relatives say, oh, well, I don't want to be a burden to my family or even to the National Health Service. Many people are like that. And that's where the pressure will come from. And no safeguard in the world can stop that from happening.
Yeah, I think that is such an important point. You know, I've been involved in an end-of-life situation over the past few years, and the sense people have of being a burden is so acute and profound. And many people will know that one of the key things one feels the instinct to do is to keep saying to them, you're not a burden, it's all fine, don't worry about it. Whereas I think legislation like this and this idea itself contributes to the sense that people are a burden and gives them a way out of being a burden. And it's the worst way out you could imagine. It's to end their life early because apparently they're too burdensome on society or someone else. I want to ask you about the other states and countries where this legislation has been introduced and where it has expanded or it has vastly gone beyond its original remit. You've been writing about places like this for a long time. You've written about Oregon, you've written about Canada, you've talked about the Netherlands and Belgium and what's happening in these countries where they've introduced so-called assisted dying. I did want to ask you specifically about the Canadian example, which you've mentioned, and this is where you're from. And it's one example of assisted suicide that has garnered international headlines. And there has been a lot of discussion about what's going on in Canada. So last month, even The Guardian published a piece saying something's up in Canada because some of the people requesting assisted death are people who do not have a terminal illness, but in many cases, have unmet social needs. So they might be homeless or they might be incredibly poor. They're seeking death as a solution to social problems, not necessarily to terminal illness. So how bad is it in Canada? I mean, is it really the case that they've introduced essentially a system of voluntary death that expands to, I guess, a pretty large section of society, if one were to boil it down?
Yes. I mean, one of the problems with this kind of legislation is that once it's passed, then it attracts no discussion whatsoever. I have one friend from Belgium who was supportive of the Belgian law when it came in. He thought, oh, yes, we are a progressive land. This is great. We should be leading in this kind of legislation. And the only reason that he turned against it was because he came home one day and he received an email saying, can you collect your mother's things? And he found out that his mother, who had struggled with mental illness and whom for the past couple of months had been estranged from this man, had ordered a euthanasia at age 58 or 56, it was, and been given it. And he had not been contacted. And suddenly, this kind of practice that happens behind closed doors most of the time was suddenly exposed to him, and he became one of its worst critics, which is, I think, what happens once you legalize it. It happens sort of more and more. It becomes a part of healthcare, and it becomes institutionalized, and then it goes under the radar. There's an interesting case in Australia where there's a gentleman called Cyril Tooze, who was 86 years old. He was diagnosed with terminal illness, and then he applied and was successful in his application to have home help come in under the Australian Universal Medicine Program. And he was told that the home help would take 10 months. So, and he could not afford to pay for private home care, and he couldn't have, with his rent. He had retired at age 82, poor man, as a carer, and he didn't have a lot of money. His nearest relatives were far away, and he just opted for an assisted suicide because he couldn't cope with these various different pressures. And this is what I think is emerging from various different places where it has been legalized. It has been legalized in more areas than, for instance, when I first started writing. It has expanded, but this isn't gay marriage. It hasn't sort of whipped through right throughout. For instance, in the United States, in the past 3 years, there have been no new areas where it has been legalized. So no new states have actually legalized. It's 10 states and the District of Columbia as well in the United States. So it's not something that can't be beaten, but it is, and it's something that you can really see is attracting so much debate here that because of this bill, that I think it's not a bad thing to have all of this debate. And I think it is something that the more people know about, the more they oppose.
I think that's right. Absolutely. I did want to ask you about, again, this is a kind of language question, but I think it's an important question about the issue of choice and, I guess, the broader question of autonomy, because I think this is, it's so interesting because firstly, the use of that word, and it is used quite frequently. I think even Kim Leadbeater has used it herself on Twitter and others around this issue. People who campaign for the so-called right to die often use the word choice, often use the words like autonomy. It's interesting to me, firstly, because that rather gives the game away about the idea that there could never be an expansion of the categories, or that this isn't a slippery slope. Because as soon as you buy into the idea that people should have this choice, they should have the choice to end it all by being given drugs by the doctor, et cetera, then why would you grant that choice to some people and deny it to others? So the logic is the logic of expansion is contained within the very idea of choice. But it also seems to me a pretty deceptive notion. I'm generally in favor of choice. I'm generally in favor of people enjoying self-government and having autonomy over their own lives and their own destinies. But on this issue, it never quite maps for me. It doesn't work. I find it very unconvincing. What's your take on the use of words like that in relation to this?
Well, I mean, first of all, there's a few points to make about that. It was not always motivated by choice. In fact, when it was first mooted as an idea in 1870 by Samuel Williams at the Birmingham Speculative Club, he motivated by two things, compassion and utility. He made the point that a person's life was of no use to themselves or to anyone else. Then we ought to feel that we can terminate this life. At that time, he suggested actually having chloroform and chloroforming these patients, chloroform being a fairly new thing in 1870. So it's never really been about choice. In fact, choice wasn't a motivation historically until the 1970s. So for instance, when euthanasia was very, very big in the United States and Britain in the 1930s, and of course in Germany in the 1930s, choice was very seldom mentioned. In fact, the voluntary euthanasia aspect was only pinned on fairly late in the game, after two bills had gone through in the United States trying to get euthanasia unsuccessfully in 1906. And those didn't work. And so the people who were campaigning for it used the idea of voluntary euthanasia, but even that's not really choice. So it's only really in the 1970s with the kind of me generation that choice became a big thing. And as you point out, it's absolutely false. You can't have choice in that matter. First of all, I'm in favor of a choice and autonomy, but I'm not in favor of choice and autonomy that destroys the general freedom. And this was the point that J.S. Mills made. J.S. Mills, one of the great prophets of autonomy and of freedom, made the point that you cannot sell yourself into slavery because that would undermine the general freedom. Now, we think that J.S. Mills, who had actually attempted suicide himself, was really talking about suicide, but certainly you can extend that principle and say, well, if you're destroying the general freedom, which of course suicide will do, then we shouldn't be in favor of it. So I think it doesn't really work. And most people, you will find, when faced with the news that the Sarko, which is the death pod introduced by Philip Nitschke into Switzerland, that's been in the news recently, it's kind of miniature gas chamber. Most people are horrified by that. But in fact, if you really take the autonomy argument right to its end point, then we should all be in favor of these little portable gas chambers, because we can do it ourselves without any assistance and without relying on a doctor. But you find that those who tout choice and autonomy are not really that keen on the Sarko.
Yeah. God, the machinery of it all. I know it's not useful to focus just on the methods, because that takes us away from the broader question of why this is happening. But some of the methods do send a chill down the spine. And I'm sure you're right, they send a chill down the collective spine. Lots of people are put off by this stuff enormously. Okay, you've said the word euthanasia there a few times. I said it earlier on as well. So let's talk a bit about that, because you will know from all the discussions that you've had on this issue over the years, if you were to say to some, you know, painfully right on middle class journalist at The Guardian or some Highgate based campaigner for dignity in dying, you know, good people, decent people who we happen to disagree with. If you were to say to any of these people who campaign for the so-called right to die, if you were to use the word euthanasia, if you were to make even a connection between the dynamic of euthanasia in the past and this movement for the so-called freedom to die in the 21st century, they would run a mile. They would think you were talking gibberish. They would not be able to see it at all. And it's kind of understandable that they wouldn't be able to see that, because the language has changed so much over time. It is now seen as a freedom question. And that advert with the woman dancing in her pajamas, which, by the way, I thought was grotesque. It was almost like a death cult image, you know, dancing around and leaping up and down at the thought of having the right to die. Really, such a sign, a warped sign of the times. The euthanasia question does need to be talked about, because the one thing that has struck me about this issue over the years is that there is a logic. The logic of euthanasia exists in this discussion, and it might be hidden beneath all the new terms. It might be hidden beneath the adoption of the language of freedom and so on, but it is still there. And you will read articles. I've read articles over the years which make the case for so-called assisted dying, which talk about the aging time bomb and which talk about the fact that it costs eight times as much to look after someone with dementia as it does someone with heart disease or whatever. People will bring in these social stats. They will bring in these medical stats as part of their argument for why a speedier end of life or a more peaceful end of life is a good idea. I mean, so this issue is tied, isn't it, in lots of ways to a kind of depressive social attitude, an attitude which says, well, maybe it's better to bump off the burdensome rather than having to pay for this stuff. And that really does bring in the logic of euthanasia, doesn't it?
Yes, and this has always, always been a conversation. This lurks underneath the whole discussion that we're having about using all of this euphemistic language, like, for instance, assisted dying, even euthanasia is, of course, you know, good death. It doesn't say anybody's doing killing. It should really be either homicide or suicide. At least that language tells us that a killing is occurring. And I think that's important. But it has always, always been part of this discussion. There was no such thing as assisted suicide or assisted dying before the 1950s, really. In fact, assisted suicide, the first time I ever saw it was in about 1950, because people didn't want to use euthanasia anymore because it was tainted by the euthanasia employed by the T4 Action group in Germany during the Second World War. And of course, the whole motivation of utility is immediately behind the discussion about, you know, it makes a mockery of the discussion of choice, because, of course, it's not really about choice. It's about, in the end, and we're seeing the evidence of this in Australia and in Canada in particular, that it is something that's being used to get rid of people whose lives are inconveniences to themselves and to others. And so, for instance, there's been a commission by an obscure Canadian government department that actually looked at how much cost savings could be made with their euthanasia program. And it was approximately $14,000 per patient. This is just strictly in healthcare terms. That doesn't include, for instance, all the pensions, housing, social care, various different other costs that are involved of a person who is not productive anymore in society. And of course, they've done the maths and come up with this $14,000 per patient. And if in the track two, what's called the track two, which includes people who are not terminally ill, the savings are $54,000 per person. And so this has been noticed, and you'll see it come bubbling up, this whole discussion. It came up with Matthew Paris in the Times, I think during the summer, where he made the point that, you know, this will come in because we can't afford to keep these people alive. It came up with a Belgian head of the largest Belgian health insurance group who said, we need to encourage elderly people to go. So this has always been under the discussion. I always tell people, look, there are people who are going for this legislation, and mostly they do it because they're compassionate and they believe that this is a compassionate thing to do. But lurking underneath the whole discussion about assisted dying is the utility argument, and it's never gone away.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I want to let you know some exciting news. My new book is out now. It's called After the Pogrom, 7th of October, Israel and the Crisis of Civilization. And it's available right now from Amazon.
I'm really proud of this book. It is an unflinching account of how the West failed the moral test of 7th of October 2023, which of course is the day that Hamas and other militants invaded Israel and unleashed barbarism. The book documents in chilling detail how activists, academics, and others in the West ended up making excuses for Hamas's violence, ended up taking the side of the pogromists against the pogrom's victims, and ended up, in the process, turning their backs on the values of civilization. The book is fundamentally a call to arms for Western civilization. It makes the case for restoring Enlightenment values and standing with Israel while it's under attack by radical Islamists. I don't know if an author is allowed to describe his own book as essential reading, but I really do think it's essential reading. It's called After the Pogrom, 7th of October, Israel and the Crisis of Civilization, and you can get your copy right now on Amazon. If you want a signed copy of the book, and why wouldn't you, you can get one by donating £50 or more to Spiked. Just go to the Spiked website, look for the donate button, donate today, and you will get a free signed copy of After the Pogrom, 7th of October, Israel and the Crisis of Civilization.
Yeah, it really is there all the time, and the logic of it just seeps through. I always think it's useful when people like Matthew Paris make those kinds of arguments, because it does draw to the surface, you know, the truth of this issue. Okay, so I want to dig into that question now a bit more depth, and I'm going to start by mentioning your book that you've already mentioned, which was called Assisted Suicide, The Liberal Humanist Case Against Legalization. That was 2013. I was very honored to write the foreword for that book. Two words in that will leap out at some people, which is the words liberal and humanist, because there's been a lot of hand-wringing over the past few weeks with the terminally ill adults bill going through the Commons about the pesky, problematic religious people, the Christian-funded groups who are kicking up a fuss about this legislation. And there is this general idea out there, or there's an idea in certain quarters, that if you're opposed to assisted dying, as it's been referred to, then you must be a religious fruitcake. You must be either a Christian guy or a Muslim person. You must have some kind of biblical or Quranic reason to oppose such a good, useful piece of legislation. Now, as it happens, I think it's perfectly legitimate for people to make a religious case against assisted dying. I don't have a problem with that at all. And I think a lot of the arguments coming from religious figures or religiously inclined figures are very good, solid arguments. But you come at it from a non-religious perspective. You're not a religious person. You are an atheist, I gather, unless things have changed since... You're still an atheist. You're a secularist, you're a humanist, you're historically a man who comes from the left. So you would not be people's first vision of the kind of person who opposes assisted dying. So when you say the liberal humanist case, what encapsulates that for you? Do you think it's different to the religious case, or are there common themes between them?
Well, first of all, I think the religious case is used to discredit all sorts of very legitimate arguments against assisted suicide and assisted dying, whatever you want to call it. So, for instance, Lord Falconer attacked one of the ministers who made a point about this and said you should keep your religious views to yourself, or you shouldn't push your religious views on anybody else. And the key thing is, hey, she wasn't making a religious argument. She wasn't saying God tells us. You know, she wasn't saying, in fact, she's Muslim, so she wasn't saying, look, suicide is haram, so we can't have this. She wasn't making those points. And it's a real attack on religious people, and particularly Christians are the ones who bear the brunt of this. And I work with many Christians, and they're forever so defensive. It just annoys me, because I think, for goodness sake, don't hide your light under a bushel. Be proud of what you are. There's no problem there. I don't have a big prejudice against Christians. They even tolerate me. They at one meeting I go to, they give a prayer at the beginning, and they always apologize. And I go, why would you apologize? You know, the worst that a prayer is to me is good thoughts. That's not very offensive to me. So, and one irritation about this whole thing is that For instance, if Lord Falconer was back 200 years, he would be attacking William Wilberforce, presumably for his religious reasons for opposing slavery, which is ridiculous, of course, when you look at it. There were perfectly good reasons for opposing slavery, and religious people and secular people agreed on that. And it's exactly the same with assisted suicide. And I think, you know, yes, I'm an atheist, but I think there's also something that is talked about by the French sociologist Durkheim, who makes a point about the cult of man, which I think is a really good kind of idea. It's saying that, you know, an atheist should have humanity as his sort of holy or, you know, religious icon, I suppose. And if you do, and this is why Durkheim really opposed suicide, because he said we cannot tolerate this if we are to regard human lives as something sacred, which I think sacrality can still come into a sort of atheistic perspective. Not all will agree with me on that, but that's okay. So, yes, I still feel like the liberal humanist that I was when I wrote that book, or when I used to campaign for abortion rights actively in the 1980s. And one thing that I was very pleased to see is that Anne Faraday, who is will be known to, I think you may have had her on your show, but anyway, she's known to many readers or listeners as somebody who fights very vociferously for abortion rights and was head of the British Pregnancy Advisory Service. And she is against now this bill and assisted suicide. And I think there are many, many different people who I could point to who are secularist. Ian Burrell, the columnist, Liz Carr, the disabled actor, who is fairly prominent. I have many, many people who I know who are atheists and who are appalled by this bill and appalled in general by assisted suicide.
Absolutely. I know many too. And there's a lot of them out there. Okay. I want to come back to the cult of man in a minute, because I think that's a really important rallying cry, actually. But I just want to ask you one specific thing in relation to this current bill and the other acts of law around the world. I've heard you deal with this question before, but I would like you to do it now on the podcast as well, which is people will often say to you, okay, you have a problem with some of this legislation. You have a problem with the fact that people who are not not terminally ill are being encapsulated into it and are being permitted to die or allowed to kill themselves. But what about the 89-year-old woman? She is on death's door. She might have 3 days left to live, 48 hours left to live. We all have been in situations like that, or we all will be in situations like that. And for a long time in the era of modern medicine, that period of life has often been ushered to a close, and it's tended to be done quite quietly. You know, the woman's son might say to the doctor, look, can you put her out of her misery? And it's really is in those last days and hours of life that tends to happen. That's not something you would be opposed to, is it? And I guess the broader question is, isn't there a possibility that this legalization of assisted dying might actually make those kinds of situations more difficult, because it would draw them into the legalistic realm where they've tended to take place in a more private sphere?
Well, precisely. I think that's absolutely right. First of all, yes, if we called that assisted dying and everything after that assisted suicide, I don't think I'd oppose the whole idea of it. But I do think it's exceptional. First of all, most deaths are peaceful. That's the good news, is that the vast majority of deaths are peaceful. However, I have attended one death in my experience, which wasn't peaceful, and which, if I'm honest, I would say the last week of that life was not worth having. But the doctor, of course, wouldn't do anything about it, because there's so much, as you say, a legal spotlight on this issue just because it's been raised. So doctors are very afraid to do anything about these kind of situations. There was, of course, the very famous death of George VI, who died in 1935, if I'm getting my numbers right. Or is it George V? Anyway, one of those Georges died in 1935. You wouldn't think I was a historian, would you? And was dispatched a little bit early by his physician, who admitted it under in Parliament, under, of course, parliamentary privilege, and you can't be sentenced for something you've admitted in Parliament. So basically, he was dispatched early because he was in great distress, but also because they wanted the morning papers to get the news first and not the evening papers, which I was found interesting. Nobody liked Standard then, and people may not like it now, I don't know. I'm not living in London anymore. But basically, yes, this occurred, as you say, many times, and it was not uncommon. There is a little bit of mythology to it in that, yes, you can actually give a huge overdose of morphine, and that can have that effect. But I know medic friends of mine who say it's actually very difficult to dispatch a patient with just a little too much morphine. Basically, what happens is the patient dies, and so they find morphine. They go, ah, the morphine has done it. Whereas, as my friend says, well, if they had a cup of tea before then, you wouldn't say, well, the cup of tea did it just after death. So I'm not absolutely convinced that that's the case. But yes, doctors can speed things along. And in fact, if you have a reasonably private situation about a death, and death should be, I think, a private family and close friends matter rather than a sort of public spectacle. And if you don't shine the legal spotlight on it, then it allows doctors to take humane actions in the very last hours and days of life. So yes, I completely agree with you there. I think the legal spotlight will not help matters, will probably even create more suffering than it alleviates.
Yeah, it's always struck me that the problem with the assisted suicide issue is that it makes things harder for people who want to live, and it makes things harder for people who might need to die, in the sense that, you know, it puts this great pressure on people who to conceive of themselves as a burden, whether as a social burden or a medical burden or a family burden, and maybe to take that exit that's been opened up to them by the state. And those who might need to be helped along because they are in the last hours, it's unbearable for them, it's unbearable for the family. It makes that quite natural part of death more difficult too, by dragging it into the kind of legal spectacle, as you say. So it's a lose-lose situation, I think, these new forms of legislation. To wind up, I want to talk to you, I guess, about the cult of man, which I would stand shoulder to shoulder with you as part of the cult of man. I think maybe we should set one up. But because it does strike me that, you know, and this is not necessarily a quantifiable observation, but it seems to me undeniable that there's a bond between society's growing loss of faith in humankind as a species and the growing attraction of the so-called right to die. So, you know, from the idea that all these old people are a problem, all these old people are a burden, and it's so tiresome to have to look after these people who've got severe disabilities or dementia or whatever else it might be, it seems that that is quite clearly tied to the idea that the world is overpopulated, we're a bit of a plague, we're causing climate change, the planet's going to end if we don't get our act together. There is this increasingly anti-humanist outlook at large in the world, in certain political quarters at least. So to what extent would you see the rehabilitation of the logic of euthanasia, if we're going to be really brutally honest about it, to what extent do you see that as an extension of these kind of social views, these political views that humankind is a bit of a plague on the planet, a bit of a pest, a bit of an annoyance. There are too many of us. We're getting too old. We're living too long. Is there a connection between these things, do you think?
Absolutely. And if you look at one of the biggest one of the most prominent people pushing both euthanasia. Euthanasia is also a big animal rights person. So Peter Singer, who is very famous for writing Animal Liberation, he's not actually in favor of animal rights, but he writes Animal Liberation, and he is also very in favor of euthanasia. And he makes the point that in some ways, a gorilla has more humanity, which is interesting idea, than a profoundly disabled person. So I think there is a metaphor of assisted suicide in that many people want to put humanity out of its misery, and that this is sort of replicated on a small basis that, you know, why should we have these people who are simply burdens? And it resonates with the idea that humanity is a burden on this planet. So why shouldn't we, self-eradicate? In fact, I have discussions, well, I've stopped them because they're just too annoying, with people who they think that human beings should annihilate themselves and that the planet would be improved by annihilating human beings altogether. Not surprisingly, they're very, very in favor of euthanasia. As I say, it's a tiny little group, but again, I run into these people once in a while. My usual approach is to say, well, you know, start this off. You go first, after you. But they never take up my challenge with that. And they seem to be the ones preaching for other people to die rather than the people that want to show a very good example and jump off that cliff first.
I think that's the voluntary human extinction movement. I mean, on one level, you're right. They're a tiny, fringe, cranky outfit and probably just something to be laughed at. But they do encapsulate a broader idea these days, which is, you know, wouldn't it be better if we'd never had the Industrial Revolution and grown from, I don't know, half a billion people to 8 billion? I mean, the logic of the kind of thing those people say is there in the kind of mainstream discussion as well.
Yes, I don't think, I think it's no coincidence, or it is a coincidence, it's not a coincidence, that the leader of the Green Party UK is one of the key sponsors of Kim Leadbeater's bill.
Absolutely, not a coincidence at all, I would say. Okay, Kevin, my last question for you is, there are many things I appreciate about the work you do and the writing that you've done, and especially the pieces you've written for Spite for a long time. But another reason is that you introduced me to G.K. Chesterton's views on suicide. And I cannot tell you how many times I've quoted this at people or sent it to people. So Chesterton famously said that suicide is the ultimate evil, the absolute evil. Now, people can use the word evil or bulk up the word evil. That's up to them. But he made this point that the man who kills a man just kills a man, whereas the man who kills himself kills all men. He wipes out the world. He refuses to live for other people, for the world itself. It's such a striking observation and one that runs so wonderfully counter, I think, to the culture that we currently live in. So to end the discussion, I just wanted to ask you, what is the best way to counter some of these depressive trends? And that goes across the board. Assisted dying, I think, is one of them, as you've just outlined very well there. But there are others too. How can we make a pro-life argument? And I don't mean that in relation to the abortion discussion. I mean that in relation to a view of the world and a view of our place in the world that values the human contribution, that values human life itself, and which values all forms of human life, even those that are quite difficult, even those that might seem strange or hard to some of us who are not experiencing them. What's the best way to counter these depressive trends and make the case for human life itself?
Well, I have found that in this discussion in particular, that's probably the very best way of bringing up the whole point about the cult of humanity, as we should probably call it, rather than the cult of man. And basically thinking about all of the positive aspects of other people's lives and what they mean to us And, you know, the whole conception of, you know, that John Donne talked about some 400 years ago, ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. The sort of sentiments encapsulated in that. I think this discussion actually, in a sort of negative way, at least brings forward the positive aspects of the lives of others. And I tend to find that people have at least a moral sense that's lurking behind that can actually be brought out by this discussion, and that they appreciate, because it's put so starkly with this discussion, they appreciate that other people's existences matter not simply to themselves, but to all of us. And underline really the point that G.K. Chesterton makes, that it is a terrible act to destroy the entire world by destroying yourself, by giving up on the world, by leaving it, by not, you know, feeling no compulsion to live in order to for other people. So I think this discussion, I know that sounds a bit trite, but I think at least in a sort of polar negative way, it actually can bring out the essence of humanity and why we should fight for it.
Kevin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.